students hostage. Tens of thousands of dollars. Debt on education, which is itself is a human right.
They have sold.
They have sold.
On legal teams that look for ways to get them out of contracts in regards to health insurance.
They continue to buy generic forms of medicine that could save people's lives or provide relief in order to protect investments.
Consistently outsource labor and use that outsourcing as leverage to cut workers' health care and pay.
They have influenced the courts to achieve the same rights as people. None of the culpability or responsibility.
Returning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. We're listening to Why Violence Has Declined with Harvard professor Steven Pinker, who's interviewed by Neil Conan, the host of Talk of the Nation on National Public Radio.
What we have produced through all of these mechanisms that we've talked about, in particular in terms of the commerce and the longer lifespans brought about public health and sanitation, and not to mention the vaccines and advances in medicine, seems to be a population that is unsustainably large, that is engaged in industrial activities which are warming the earth to such an extent that we are going to have Malthusian conflicts over water, over land, because people can no longer live where they used to live and farm where they used to farm, that this is going to be a future that is going to be unlike the past.
Yes, like the great American Civil War of the 1930s, when because of the Dust Bowl and the Depression and all the Okies moving west, we had a civil war. Now, of course, we didn't have a civil war. There was a lot of misery. There was certainly conflict. There wasn't necessarily war. And the prediction, well, there's going to be resource shortage, therefore there's going to be war, actually has to be given a second thought. And this is not in any way a denial of the seriousness of climate change and global warming. It caused an enormous amount of misery and waste without necessarily causing a war. Because wars, contrary to most people's beliefs, are typically not fought, or at least haven't been for a long time, over resources. They are fought over honor and revenge and fear and ideology. But the thing about resources is they're the one thing that you really can split. You can't split whether Jerusalem is going to be a holy, undivided city for all eternity. That's kind of hard to compromise on. But there's a pool of water, a pool of oil, who gets to use it? You really can divide it up. And statistical studies, as opposed to anecdotes, that try to look at a correlation between resource shortage at time one and war at time two, say in parts of Africa that have had drought and so on, find little to no correlation.
And I want to bring us back to where we started. Your mom obviously went to the same mom school that mine did. Her answer as to why you can't put your peas on your fork with your knife was, because I said so. But that is another factor through all of this that you write consistently through the book, and that is the civilizing impact of women.
Yes, so I think that feminization is another of the major forces that have contributed to declines of violence in a number of ways. For one thing, violence is kind of a guy thing. You look at any statistic on violence, homicides committed, assaults, violent fantasies, play fighting in kids. Every time it's the male gender that is responsible for the lion's share of the violence. In a world in which women are more empowered, glory, honor, grandeur, conquest just aren't as sexy to women as they are to men. on average. I mean, there are exceptions. So that's one factor. The other factor is when women are empowered, in particularly when they have control over their own reproduction, which is often the most heavily contested battleground in the war between the sexes and the empowerment of women, they don't have as many babies. They get married later. They have their first child later. They stop having children sooner. And so you don't have these youth bulges where you have enormous numbers of young people with nothing to do except get into trouble. And parts of the world that have, in which women have access to contraception, abortion, marriages are arranged by the bride and groom as opposed to the parents and grandparents. Women are not betrothed in their teens. Those parts have lower birth rates and tend to have lower rates of violence.
I was fascinated to read the description that the greatest factor that changed the very high rates of violence in the old American West, the Wild West, was not the arrival of the sodbusters or indeed the flinty-eyed marshal, but the school marm.
Yes. Well, yes, there's another cliche of the old cowboy movies that has some element of truth, that when the West was a largely male enclave, you had men who would, just like in the cowboy movies, they'd go to the saloons, they would get drunk, one would insult the other, there'd be furniture flying, gunshots, and bodies on the floor. The women would largely be prostitutes, and so the life was basically whoring and gambling and boozing. Then
there was a little hard work involved in there too, but yeah.
During the day, and then then in a second wave, more and more women moved out west. There were spinsters and widows, and the gender imbalance was
Civil War helped with that. Yeah.
Civil War helped with that. Yeah, nature abhors a lopsided sex ratio, and so women's, and as they moved west, they were. Did not put up with this whoring, gambling, boozing lifestyle, and they started to impose what we call family values. With the help of the church, with the ministers, and they kind of shut down the brothels and had the men dress up and go to church on Sunday morning and tried to make it a little more family-friendly because there's nothing in it for them, life of whoring and boozing. And so the women really were, it sounds kind of corny and old-fashioned, but in a very real sense, women were a civilizing force in the American West.
Stephen Pinker, I can't imagine that anybody's going to not have some arguments with you, but I can't also imagine that anybody doesn't wish that you're really right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tune in to great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with great speeches and interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And now, another episode of I Live Loosely, in which three wild, wacky members of the Senate Judiciary Committee pass judgment on the morality of Clarence Thomas. Please welcome Mr. Biden, Mr. DeConcini, and Mr. Kennedy.
When I got to the Senate, I got to be the chair of Committee of Judiciary. I pass lots of laws that are quite PC, and I make sure not a one of them applies to me.
Not a solitary one of them applies to we.
I do this with impunity, and now I am the ruler of morality.
To be, says he,
or not to be.
That's a quote from Mr. Biden of Judiciary.
I think that it's awful when men harass. It's rude and despicable and shows no class. When I hire a receptionist, I want a lass who impresses me because she has a lovely ass. Resume.
To say what he really thinks of her would be too crass.
I check her assiduity.
If it's firm enough, I'll let her work for me.
We carefully assess if she is an asset to the rulers of morality. And then we evaluated Clarence T. to see if he was worthy as a nominee. He had his subpoenas. He had to answer me by explaining just how long is his pedigree.
To this member, it's a matter of enormity.
Now Jesse Helms is mad at me,
and he's cutting off the funding for judiciary.
This ding-dong hearing ought to see a condemnation
as pornography.
This is Radio Ego Shock with Alex Smith.
If we lose faith in our future, can that help bring about the catastrophe we fear? Donald B. Luria is a medical MD and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He asked, are we losing our faith in the future? If we do, what are the likely consequences? Luria was leading into his studies on the impacts of pessimism and his book titled Rethink, a 21st Century Approach to Preventing Societal Catastrophes. First, I'm going to play you 4 minutes from his comments at the symposium, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident. But he's talking about a lot more than that.
I've devoted myself to systems. Nuclear power is part of the energy system. And for a few moments, I'd like to focus on a broader context. If this conference makes the judgment that nuclear power should be restricted and then abandoned, it has, of course, huge implications for the energy mix that we use. It does more than that, though. It emphasizes, in my judgment, three interrelated questions. One relates to the mix that we are going to use for energy. And more directly, it raises the question as to why the United States and other nations have not developed a veritable Marshall Plan for the acquisition of alternative environmentally friendly energy sources. That we have not is an absolute disgrace. The second question is, if we move vigorously, when is it realistic to expect that we will have enough abundant alternative energy sources that we can profoundly reduce the use of fossil fuel? And related to that, since any realistic projection, even if we do move vigorously, indicates that it's going to be quite some time, what are we going to be using for our energy mix in the intervening years? Now, these three interrelated questions lead me to what I think is the most important, most critical single question and issue, and that is the following. At the rate we are going, in the absence of very vigorous action, when, that is, what year, do we reach the tipping point, beyond which the damage we're doing to the environment, global climate change consequences, are so severe that societal devastation and catastrophe is virtually inevitable? I believe that in the coming years, that is going to be the centerpiece of the debate. And why shouldn't it be? After all, what's at stake is the very survival of our society, at least a society as we know it now. Because I am interested in systems, a few weeks ago, I put together two systems diagrams related to the tipping point. One is pessimistic, the other optimistic. The pessimistic one assumes that we will continue with business as usual, that whatever actions we take are going to be inadequate, and that we do not manage successfully the critical determinants related to the tipping point, such as population size and population growth, CO2 emissions, control of methane sources, among others. And that these important factors, these determinants, then converging, the ones I mentioned plus others, will result in a tipping point with societal devastation. The optimistic scenario is just the opposite, that we will act vigorously, we will control and manage the determinants, and we will avoid the tipping point. Now, one other aspect that I think is worth mentioning. If people in our society, especially young people, get to believe that the pessimistic scenario is the more likely, that a tipping point will occur, that perception will likely result in loss of faith in the future. And that loss of faith in the future among people in the society has dire consequences for individuals and for the society, and is in point of fact virtually independent of whether the tipping point actually occurs. All that's needed is the perception that it will occur.
That was Dr. Donald B. Luria. I think he raises a deep problem for us all. To fill out his comments, I'm just going to read directly from Luria's explanation of his book, Rethink, as published online in September 2010. Quote, in 2005 and in 2007, I and my colleagues carried out national studies to assess the perceptions of people about their own future, the future of their country, and the future of the world. The respondents were divided into four age groups, 18 to 24 years, 25 to 44 years, 45 to 64 years, and over 65. In every age group, more than 80% were optimistic about their own future, but in every age group, the majority were pessimistic about the future of the United States and the world. Importantly, the majority in each of the four age groupings believed we are not able to solve or significantly mitigate the major problems facing us, such as terrorism, global warming, the potential for nuclear or biological warfare. These studies strongly suggested that Americans of all ages are well on their way to losing faith in the future. Since our last survey, more than 2 years ago, a number of events have occurred that almost certainly will accelerate that loss of confidence in the future, reduce optimism about one's own future, and increase the pessimism about the future of the United States and the world. There has been a severe recession, and with it, a terrible toll in lost jobs and diminished confidence. There is increasing distrust of Congress that seems unable to deal effectively with our most serious problems. The countries of the world, including the United States, appear unwilling to take the necessary actions to avoid catastrophic consequences of global climate change. We are told that unless healthcare costs are contained, our healthcare system system will eventually bankrupt the country. Yet despite an extended and acrimonious debate, there is nothing to suggest our government has figured out a way to cope with or prevent this looming disaster. I fear we are now in great danger of a large percentage of the public having their hopes for the future battered, being overwhelmed by feelings of hopelessness in regard to our ability to cope with the major problems facing society. If that occurs, there are substantial societal and individual consequences. There will be a dramatic increase in the frequency and severity of anxiety and depression. There will be a much greater focus on hedonism, with increased risk-taking and pleasure-seeking, including the use of mind-altering drugs, both legal and illegal, alcohol included. There will be little attention paid to preventing or mitigating future problems and threats. Politicians, even more than now, will focus almost entirely on present issues, thereby making the future even more bleak. The depression epidemic will have physical and other consequences, with increased incidence of suicide and heart attacks, marital discord, inability to function effectively, and overeating, a well-known response to depression, that will exacerbate our obesity and diabetes epidemics. Make no mistake about it, loss of faith in the future is a very serious business. If widespread enough, it is society-threatening. There is, in my judgment, only one preventative. People, especially young adults, must be convinced that we, as a society, are still meliorist, that is, able to solve the major problems facing us by the dint of our own efforts. That, in turn, means our politicians and leaders must give the perception they are approaching major issues in potentially effective fashion. To do so, they must know when to use and how to use what I have called societally connected systems thinking. That is why I wrote the book Rethink, A 21st Century Approach to Preventing Societal Catastrophes. Now, the questions for me are, will my recommendations about how to approach major societal issues be implemented by educational institutions and the political establishment? Will the book be read by sufficient numbers of people to give societally connected systems thinking a chance? Will anyone even care? And that was a reading from Donald B. Loria talking about his new book. In my opinion, the book Rethink, A 21st Century Approach to Preventing Societal Catastrophes, looks a little academic for most of us. The ideas in it need to be popularized somehow. It's almost idealistic to think there is a social body, even government, that rationally analyzes our direction towards the future instead of taking bribes and takes action to avoid catastrophic futures. But that is just the negative thinking Luria is talking about. There have been some successes, haven't there? For example, we did manage to remove absolutely harmful substances from the food supply for a while, although that is lapsing. Humans in developed countries have set up a medical system. It's not available to all in the United States, of course. The Western nations managed to defeat the most evil regime that emerged in Europe in Nazi Germany. The Soviet Union and the United States managed to avoid an all-out nuclear war. But so far, there is no sign we are doing anything about climate change except making it worse, or about overpopulation, or the unjust distribution of wealth, all of which can have fatal consequences. Recent news articles and studies show Americans and Brits are indeed turning to more and more psychiatric and illegal drugs. Suicides are still ongoing. Stress levels are very high. According to the signs listed by Loria, we are already engaged in loss of the future. As we heard, this in itself could determine our future, whether the expected disaster arrives sooner, later, or never. On the other hand, how can we change our direction if we don't know our current situation or the possible futures? Thinking happy thoughts and leading disconnected lives isn't going to do it.
Thank you. That's all, folks.